We'll hear argument now in the case of State Bank of Lakes against the Kansas Bankers Surety Company. Ms. Hoover.
May it please the court. This appeal comes to the court from a trial, bench trial. The Kansas Bankers Surety Company issued a financial institution claim bond.
I wonder if you could speak up just a bit.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The Kansas Bankers Surety Company issued a financial institution crime bond to State Bank of the Lakes as a result of a claim asserted by State Bank of the Lakes for a loss it sustained by the acceptance of unsigned manufacturer statements of origin from its customer, Pistaki Marina. And this case involves the interpretation of Clause E of that financial institution crime bond. The financial institution crime bond issued by KBS tracks the standard language that's contained in the financial institution Form 24 bond. Therefore, the interpretation of this provision, Insuring Agreement E, not only has significance as it relates to Kansas Bankers Surety Company, but also to the insurance industry that issues this type of bond and to the financial institutions who purchase it. The issues that were before the court relating to Clause E presented questions of first impression for the court. Specifically, those pertain to interpreting the good faith provision under Insuring Agreement E and whether unsigned MSOs meet the definition of certificate of origin or title under the bond. In addition to this, the issue became whether a missing signature on the MSO was significant for purposes of the validity of the document. And the appeals here today centers around those issues.
It seems to me there are really two points that we need to address. One is why, what basis in the law, and this is all state law, so it's a little unfortunate that we're a federal court, but what basis in the law is there to choose your definition of good faith over any of the many other definitions of good faith that are out there? You can even compare, just by way of analogy, the definition of good faith under Article 2 of the UCC with the definition of good faith under Article 3 of the UCC, and on and on. It's one of those phrases that carries many different meanings depending on the context. So good faith is one thing that troubles me. The second is, you seem to think something's not a counterfeit until people have filled in the form, as it were. And it seems to me, again, that depends on what you think a counterfeit is. If somebody produces a perfect copy of, you know, a stock certificate or any kind of instrument like that, so that anybody who comes along can fill it in, maybe it's already a counterfeit. That's what the district judge thought. And again, it's a definitional question, and I think we need some grounding in law to decide how to answer it.
With respect to the first question dealing with the basis of law for good faith, certainly as it relates to the cases, the existing case law that's out there, the cases are few. The basis that we say to adopt a commercial reasonableness standard for purposes of good faith comes from the bond itself. If you construe the bond and look at it as a whole, the purpose behind the bond is one to prevent forms of risk that a bank cannot avoid, not avoidable
risk. But
then
why doesn't your bond say, use the word negligent rather than the phrase in good faith? And normally in law we think of these as different, which is one reason why one ought to be suspicious when you come and say good faith and negligence just mean the same thing. If they were negligent, they couldn't have been in good faith.
The drafters of the bond obviously chose not to define good faith within the bond itself. But in terms of the analysis that the...
But negligence is normally viewed objectively, and good faith is normally viewed subjectively. I mean, these are just almost polar opposite concepts in law. Why should we treat one as identical to the other in a bond that does not define them that way? Right? If you want a subjective standard, you use good faith. If you want an objective standard, you put in a word like negligence.
Well, Your Honor, if you adopt the reasoning of the district court, and if you treat it as you have said, with a subjective intent, you have, in essence, reassigned the risk of this policy, and you have, in essence, incorporated into the policy a standard that it is not designed to ensure.
But there's a problem with that. I mean, let me suggest a couple of problems. One of them is sort of the purely legal point. If you're going to look at the bond as a whole, a great number of state laws, including the law of Illinois, normally construe insurance-like arrangements in favor of the insured and against the insurer. So you have that doctrine. But secondly, taking your argument about incentives to the logical extreme, you seem to think that banks will adopt extraordinarily careless practices just because they know these bonds are there. And I'm skeptical that their self-interest is so shallow. It seems to me they probably... anyway, have an incentive to read documents that are given to them and to have reasonable business practices in place, because who wants a lawsuit if you can just do it right to begin with?
But, Your Honor, I think, and I would respectfully disagree to this point, I think if the interpretation of good faith under this policy is the subjective interpretation, it encourages a bank to engage in sloppy and or negligent type of banking behavior. I think it enables a bank to perceive that the bond covers every kind of risk.
Do your rates for these bonds depend on experience with the particular client?
Yes, they do.
So a client that was really sloppy and had a bunch of empty-headed employees who were in perfect good faith but constantly being taken in by con men would reflect a higher number of payments and therefore a higher premium over time from you.
If indeed that information was made known to not only Kansas Banker Surety Company or any insurer who insures a financial institution, that would certainly be a consideration. But what, in essence, the district court's ruling did by raising the level of good faith to a showing of bad faith was to take and actually ensure a negligence kind of standard.
Why don't you put negligence in the contract?
Negligence isn't in the contract as an exclusion, Your Honor. That is true.
Well, I know it's not.
Bond,
that's why we're here, but I said, why didn't you put it in?
This particular company did not add a negligence exclusion to the policy as it relates to this standard form language. It adopted the standard form under insuring agreement E as is.
But there were changes made to the standard form, were there not?
There are changes to the standard form. Those are unrelated to this particular insuring agreement and, frankly, to the exclusions that would apply to this agreement. The bond on its face states very clearly that it is not a faithful performance of duty bond or a statutory bond. That's not what this type of bond covers as a whole, not just specifically relating to insuring agreement E, but to the insuring agreement as a whole. I do want to address your second.
You better do it quickly or save it for rebuttal.
I'll save it for rebuttal because my light is on, but I will address that, which is the second issue that we raise on appeal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Hoover. Mr. Tannen.
May it please the court. William Slater was sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison for the crimes that he perpetrated upon State Bank. I have been litigating this case for nearly 5 years, trying to seek Kansas Bankers' obligations under the crime bond to provide coverage for crimes.
But they, at least, you have to give them consistency on their view about sort of the reasonable standard of care they think you should have applied. They paid right away on the phony manufacturer certificates that had signatures on them, even though the signatures were undoubtedly phony too and everything about them was dead. Wasn't that some $101,000 or so?
Your Honor, I happen to believe that the distinction between a bogus...
I'm just making the point. Their position has been consistent that this good faith standard looks much more like the negotiable instruments good faith standard in UCC Article 3 that calls for reasonable commercial practices than it is... I'm just saying, that's their position. You want us to adopt the subjective, sort of much broader position about good faith, and I'm still interested, since I can find very little law to help me predict what Illinois would do with this. I wish people would file these cases sometimes in state court, especially when it's brand new, since unfortunately this will decide this case today. An Illinois trial court tomorrow could decide we were all wet.
We filed in state court. Kansas Bankers removed it, unfortunately. I think there is guidance for the definition of good faith, and I just like to make an analogy. The Eskimo language has 75 different words for ice and snow. Good faith at the other end of the extreme is one of the most...
That's actually an urban legend.
That's
an urban legend. There is actually an Inuit Language Institute which has tried to determine whether that's true, and it's not.
Well, they have many more definitions of snow and ice than there, in any event.
Actually, they don't. One of the interesting findings.
Good faith is a very, very slippery concept under the law. I cited a case in my brief that the UCC definitions cannot be incorporated into an insurance contract.
No, nobody's talking about incorporation. What we're looking for is if we were an Illinois common law court trying to construe this contract, and it calls for the insured having in good faith done certain things, is this the kind of contract that an Illinois court would think incorporates some minimal standard of care? For instance, if the bank's employees never even opened the envelope and just went and gave the envelope with a pure heart to the man who wrote the checks and he gave them checks, is that all right? At what point of empty mind, clean heart, does this bond stop, if ever?
The language that you're mentioning, it echoes to me a very important case that this circuit decided, which is the Cincinnati insurance case. And the insurance company was criticized by this circuit for not defining bad faith in the policy, just like Kansas Bankers did not define good faith, and then using its own definition to deprive the insured of coverage.
Well, and there you have, I think, a strong point under Illinois law, which is that Illinois, when there are ambiguities in insurance contracts, typically, at least most states, Illinois as well, typically construes those ambiguities against the person who wrote the policy.
Absolutely right.
So that's a legal rule that I can get my hands on. Good faith stuff is a little harder.
What I can say is that every single case the Kansas Bankers relied on in support of its good faith discussion involved a systemic overall failure in due diligence from the beginning of the transaction until the end. There were cases where a bank loaned money without having possession of the documents. There was a case where the bank ignored the advice of its own lawyer. I believe it's a continuum, and that is
so
why.
So, where in that continuum do we make the transition from an objective component to the good faith to the purely subjective?
I would say, Your Honor, that, and I'm trying to answer this directly, that the cases involving what is a counterfeit and what is not, I think, provide some guidance. If a counterfeit is so facially on its face defective that it would cause a reasonably honest person to raise some eyebrows, that might not be good faith. But in this situation, we have a case where we made a good loan to a good guy who we thought was a good guy. He duped everybody. He duped five banks in the state bank region. He duped his own son. His son was shocked. So I do think it's a continuum. The cases I think that Kansas Bankers relies on are completely inapposite, involved a total failure of due diligence. I think the Cincinnati insurance case, I think Judge Bucklow was relying on, both for the definition of bad faith and both for the underlying insurance tenets, that you can't not define a term and then create your own self-serving definition. I would like to...
Could I turn to counterfeit for just a minute? Because
yes.
Here's the hypothetical that bothers me about that. Suppose, and this may not be a perfect example, but suppose somebody made a perfect duplicate of my check from my checking account, and they filled it out completely, except there's no signature on the signature line, and they tendered it as payment, and somebody at a bank didn't pay any attention to the fact that there was no signature and accepted it. Is that check without a signature something that anybody reasonable would think was a valid check on my account? Was a valid instrument to draw money from my account, I should say?
Well, a check needs to be signed in order to be negotiable.
Right.
And
that's the point. So I'm just trying to get at the counterfeit. Whether these manufacturer certificates have to be signed is a separate issue, as I see it. But if they do have to be signed and it isn't signed, the analogy I was thinking of was, say, to the letter of credit area, where banks look at the documents that go along with the letter of credit for superficial regularity, and they don't have to investigate them, they don't have to do anything. If they're superficially okay, that's enough. But a missing signature on a bill of lading, for example, would make it insufficient.
I'm not sure I agree with you, and I would say, with respect to this case, Kansas Bankers presented no evidence at all. It presented only argument that an unsigned MSO has no effect. They could have called Mr. Boyle, the state voting official. They never did.
Isn't that a legal question? Why is that a factual question? I mean, as you just correctly pointed out, the law is very clear with respect to checks and negotiable instruments that there has to be a written signature. We wouldn't think of that as a factual question, would we?
I think it's probably a mixed question, and I think because Kansas Bankers failed to define MSO as requiring a signature, that for that reason, the term MSO is ambiguous.
But what if the law of Illinois said it's not sufficient to convey, to transfer ownership without a signature, and they say an MSO has to be something sufficient to transfer ownership?
What I would argue is that if the MSO is a the counterfeit MSO is a good counterfeit, but it's lacking a signature, it still might be considered a counterfeit under the case law of the Seventh Circuit and the case law interpreting what a counterfeit is.
But you wouldn't say the same thing about a check, just because you happen to know that checks need signatures.
I think that's right. And I would also say, in the hypothetical that you gave me, there wasn't any crime involved. Again, this was like my mantra for 5 years. The crime bond covers crimes. This man is in jail for his crimes. He duped everybody. Kansas Banker should pay. I would like to spend a moment on our cross appeal and the refusal of the district court to find 155 violation. I think it's patently outrageous for Kansas Bankers to have argued for 5 years that these counterfeits weren't good counterfeits when Mr. Towle had never even placed them side by side. He didn't do it until I cross-examined him on the stand. I think that for all the reasons that fees were denied under 155 in the Cincinnati insurance case, they should be awarded here. We gave Kansas Bankers all the information they needed to process this claim. I do not necessarily believe this is a case of first impression. The Brunson case, the Cincinnati insurance case, there's a Seventh Circuit case that says that reasonable expectations applies to crime bonds. There's case law involving what a counterfeit is. I think Kansas Bankers not only forced us to file suit, they forced us to go to trial. After losing motion after motion after motion, after Judge Bucklow declared her skepticism about this entire construct of theirs, they withdrew all offers and we had to go to trial. So, unless you have any other questions, I would ask that the district court's findings of fact and conclusions of law be affirmed in all respects except for the denial of our fees under 155, and I would ask that portion of the case be remanded. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Anything further, Ms. Hoover?
As it relates to the last argument, let me just say that every element of the Citizens Bank of Princeton case was satisfied here in terms of Kansas Banker Surety Company's response to this claim and handling of this claim, and we do not think it is appropriate to award fees in this case against the company because of its good faith opposition to the position of State Bank of the Lakes. Getting back, however, to your earlier questions, if the document requires a signature, it should be there. You asked what level...
Does it require a signature?
It is undisputed. The original manufacturer's statements of origin carry a signature. There's a signature line, and that is an undisputed fact in this case, that the original manufacturer's statements of origin that are issued by the manufacturer are signed documents. Yes, it requires a signature. And in this particular case, a very little level could have been done by this bank. It could have looked at the documents to determine whether or not there was a signature. It could have checked the invoices for staleness, and it could have performed a UCC search.
And not doing so was a lack of good faith.
It was commercially unreasonable,
was it negligent?
We believe that it was a lack of good faith under the terms
not negligent
of the bond.
Not negligent.
The negligence standard is one that the court imposed.
What do you think it requires? What's the contact require? Were they negligent in looking, or did they act in bad faith?
They did not follow commercial reasonableness, and if you want to equate that to a negligence standard, then that is...
I don't know why I was asking you what you equate.
I do not equate a lack of good faith to the level of dishonesty in fact or bad faith. And as it relates to the second question that you had in terms of the manufacturer statement of origin in this case, clearly they are defined as certificates of title. Under the definition of certificates of title or origin. And
where are they so defined?
The manufacturer's statement of origin is a certificate of title or origin, and that term is defined in the bond. And as it relates to this case, going back to the fact that the original signatures require and have, or the original MSO has a signature to transfer title, these documents had no signature, therefore they do not, they are not a duplicate of the existing original. They don't even come close because the significant particular is missing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. It's taken under advisement.